Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 30th of December. We're going to talk about the best books of 2010 this hour. We are trying to reach at the moment Sam Tannenhaus, who is the editor of both the New York Times Book Review and the Week in Review section of the Times. From 1999 to 2004, he was contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where he often wrote on politics, and his work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the New Republic, the New York Review of Books, and many other publications. He's written several books himself. Whitaker Chambers, a biography which won the L.A. Times Book Prize and was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. And he's also the author of The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences. We are trying to locate him by phone right now, and I hope we find him because we want to talk about the best books of 2010. The New York Times always puts together a list and included in their fiction for the best 10 books of 2010, Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, The New Yorker Stories, Room, Selected Stories by William Trevor, A Visit from the Goon Squad, their nonfiction selections, Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet, Cleopatra, A Life, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, Finishing the Hat, Collected Lyrics with Attendant Comments, Principles, Heresies, Grudges, Wines, and Anecdotes by Stephen Sondheim, and The Warmth of Other Suns, which I have to list up there as number one on my list of the best books of last year, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration by Isabel Wilkerson. It's a remarkable story. The Times says it's a masterly and engrossing account of the Great Migration, in which 6 million African Americans abandoned in the South between 1915 and 1970, and the book centers on the journeys of three black migrants, each representing a different decade and a different destination. One of those destinations was Milwaukee. They also have asked their book review writers to compile their lists of the top 10 books of 2010. And some of these are books that we did interviews with. Frank, The Voice by James Kaplan, which is a marvelous book about Frank Sinatra. Absolutely wonderful. We had great fun that show. We played music from Frank Sinatra, and the book was quite fascinating. Just Kids by Patti Smith, which became an award-winning book of last year. And that was a book that Chrissy said you ought to do. And I said, I'm not sure. And so I read it, and it was very, very good. And she was such an interesting person to interview as well, one of a kind. So we will be talking about books, and we hope to have Sam with us momentarily. They are not answering their phones right now. I assume that the snow has been cleared from New York, and I hope that I hope they wrote down in their calendar that they're supposed to do this interview today, and they will contact us in case we continue to have a problem getting a hold of them. It doesn't mean that we can't talk about your best books of 2010. And the idea of the show was to look at the books that were released during the last year. So if you would like to join our conversation, even if we do reach Sam, which we are confident that we will, here's the phone number for you to call with your best read of the past year. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Let me grab, hold on one second, I have to grab on the other side of the studio, our guest for the second hour of the program, which I may as well tell you about before we get rolling on the first hour. This is a really interesting book, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. Unfinished Business is the name of this book. Lee Kravitz is the author, and he loses his job. He's a guy who works very, very hard. He's a magazine editor, and he starts thinking about all of the people in his life that he's disconnected from and people who matter the most. He owes one person $600. He goes to give that person the money. He goes to somebody who was extremely influential when he was an adolescent. He tries to make amends with some of his family members. And he takes essentially 10 transformational journeys. And they're all very, very interesting. And I guess that all of us, and we think about this perhaps as we approach a brand new year, we think about our unfinished business, the things that perhaps we should have done, but we just let slip. And he decided that he would do something about this. And it's a really engaging book. He grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and he attended Yale and Columbia universities. He is an award-winning journalist and most recently was editor-in-chief of Parade magazine. So that will be our show for the second hour of today's program. All right, you got to help me out now because we can't find Sam. And I really do want to talk about the best books of 2010. It's something that we traditionally do. Did any of you read Freedom? That was selected in fiction as one of the best books by Jonathan Franzen. And we do have Sam, and that is marvelous. I'm interested in your response to that. I did read that. It was, I read so much nonfiction during the year that I don't get a chance to read much fiction. But it was way up on the list here. And I know some people loved the book and some didn't like it all that much. So we can talk about that and all of the other books that were on the list. So Sam is with us. Our number is 800-486-8655. I think he's with us. Sam, are you there? No, Sam is not with us. I'm sorry. I thought we had reached him. Let's just go to your phone calls. I'm sorry. We're a little confused here. 800-486-8655. And you can talk about what your best read was from the year 2010, preferably books that were new during last year. Did you hear the interview we did? And did anybody read The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration? I would put that as my number one book of the nonfiction books that I read, and that was listed as one of the best books as well of 2010. Okay, let's just go to your phone calls. I don't know where Sam is, but we can do this with you. You are readers. Sean is our first caller on the road. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, you know, it could be a little better. We could have a guest, but you're our guest right now. So
that's awesome. Thank you.
Yes. What was your best read?
My best read this year was, it's a new book in a series that an author named Eric Flint has been putting out for a few years. It's the 1632 series. But the latest book is The Eastern Front. The entire series is about this this made-up town from West Virginia that gets transported back in time to central Germany during the middle of the 30 Years' War.
Oh.
And it's a really interesting read because from the time that the entire town is taken back to 1632 originally, they deal with all of the political infighting and dealing with the royalty and the kings and trying to find their niche. And they eventually wind up basically making the United States in Europe. They band together a bunch of these little principalities and just little areas all across Europe into what we would consider like the United States, the same kind of constitution and everything. And the latest book has to deal with the part of the 30 Years' War that the Swedish king, Gustav Adolf, is fighting on the eastern side against the Austrian Habsburgs.
And I didn't catch the name of the book, Sean.
The name of the book is 1635.
Oh, 1635.
Front.
Okay.
And I believe it was released in October of this year.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sean.
Not a problem.
Thanks for getting us rolling here this morning. We are talking about the best books of 2010, your best reads of 2010. We had hoped to have the editor of the New York Times, a book review section, and the Week in Review section, but we do not know where he is right now. So we're talking with you because one of the great pleasures of public radio is knowing that we have an audience filled with people who read and read pretty voraciously. So we can do this. Laurel is next in Madison. Hi, Laurel.
Hello.
Hi, Laurel.
Hi. My favorite 2010 book is Warmth of Other Suns.
Mine as well.
Yes. I think for me it was a revelation that all the migrations, all the people that I knew when I was growing up as a child who had come here from the South had similar stories, and it wasn't a coincidence that this African American immigration took place, it was, you know, due to circumstances in the South that propelled people to have to leave their homes.
She is such a beautiful, stirring writer, too, isn't she? It was just totally engrossing, I thought, and such detail.
Well, it was like reading fiction.
Right.
It was so. She was such a beautiful writer. You're right, that you fell in love with the people that she was talking about, and you really cared about their progress throughout the decades as they went through their struggles from making the decision to leave home, and then what happened to them as they moved on.
Yeah. I was surprised when I read it that somebody hadn't done this book before. It took until this year for somebody to write that kind of story. It was a breakthrough book in some ways. Not that nobody's written the story, but the magnitude of it. It captured it in its hardship and also in the interesting people who came here and gave the whole history of what was going on. I don't think that kind of book has been done before.
Well, I think you're right. I think that's one of the things that was amazing about it, is that I think we were all ignorant of this history. It hadn't been written before. A friend of mine lent me a book by Jacob Lawrence called The Migration Series, which he's an African-American painter. And I think, I'm not sure if it was in the 1930s, but he actually did paintings of this migration from the South to the North. So that is another interesting kind of a connection there, that he was able to describe it in paintings, what happened.
Yes. Oh, good. I'll look that one up. What are you reading now? Do you have one now?
I'm reading a book called The Late Homecomers. A Hmong family memoir.
Hmm.
It was a book that I heard the author at the Wisconsin Book Festival.
Oh.
And she's a young Hmong woman from Minnesota, and she talks about her stories, that the Hmong story has never been written. All of these people who have come from Laos and have fought, you know, for the Americans in the Vietnam War, their story has never really been told. So she tells the story of her families coming from the mountains of Thailand and the refugee camps to Minnesota and California.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Laurel, for your call.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Bye.
Our number is 800-486-8655. The best books of 2010. We go to Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Sorry to violate the more than one call a week.
That's okay. We need you today.
Glad to be able to at least mention a couple of them. One I mentioned before when you had Professor Park on, Nothing to Envy by Barbara Demick, and it's subtitled Ordinary Lives of North Koreans, and it is fascinating.
Mm.
What an amazing and bizarre place to live.
Mm-hmm.
That's very good. Just finished that. I also enjoyed, and I think this is from this year, Paul Newman, A Life. There was quite a gentleman. If you want to come away admiring a celebrity, I think that would work for you.
Okay.
Right now I'm reading one called To Hell Holes and Back, about travel in the travel. He picks places nobody'd ever want to go. He's warned. A guy named Chuck Thompson wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
He's warned. These are he goes to. He picks a continent, Africa, a country, India, and a city, Mexico City, and I forget what he calls the last one, but it's Disneyland. or Disney World, I'm sorry. And I haven't gotten him into Disney World yet, but he's just a really entertaining writer, and he comes away not bashing these places, but just going, he goes to the Congo and, the slums of India and bad parts of Mexico City, and pretty much comes away thinking, yeah, this is okay. You can do this. So that's pretty good. And,
did he make you want to go to any of those places, Scott?
Not so much. maybe Mexico City. Yeah, actually maybe Mexico City.
Okay.
He he was very, very complimentary of it. And, you know, he went there thinking this was going to be one because of all the, you know, the terrible reputation it's developed, you know, for being polluted and being crime-ridden. And he goes down there and says, yeah, not so bad. In fact, he said it's one of the best places if you want to just go and eat. The food is wonderful, and there's great variety and everything like that. And another one's kind of interesting. It's called The Week at the Airport.
The Week at the Airport.
A week at the airport.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And what happened was this guy took a contract to spend an entire week at the new wing of Heathrow Airport in London, and just talks about everything that goes on. And you wouldn't think it's interesting, but he's a good writer, and it is. You know, he talks about the screening of baggage, the meal preparations, people have to clean the planes, and very, very, very interesting look at the life of an airport.
Good talk show material, Scott.
Yeah, I think he'd be an interesting guy to talk to.
Okay.
If you can get a hold of Barbara Dimmock and talk about her book.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. That would be prime.
Okay. We'll do that. Scott, Happy New Year. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and all the best. Your staff is wonderful, as I think I've told you before, but you guys do a wonderful job.
Thank you. They don't mind hearing it again. They do a wonderful job, and we did find Sam, so that's good. We'll link up with him in just one moment, and welcome more of your phone calls. The best books of 2010 this hour. Sam Tannenhaus will be joining us in just one moment. He is the editor of the book review section, and also of the weekend review section, my favorite part of the New York Times. I go to it first every Sunday. I should tell them that. That's the first thing I read. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. New York Times book review editor and editor of Weekend Review, Sam Tannenhaus, is with us now. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Okay, first a slight correction. I don't do the Weekend Review any longer.
Oh, you don't?
No, I handed it off to a fantastic editor named Dave Smith, so he should get all your praise.
Dave Smith, thank you for the Weekend Review. Sam, thank you for the book review section of the New York Times. How is New York today? Is the snow cleared finally?
Well, it's not cleared, but we're digging out. It got a lot warmer, so it's starting to melt.
Good.
And, of course, what'll happen is it'll freeze over, and then we'll all be skating to work.
Yeah, well, at least you can get to work if you got a pair of skates.
Friends are running.
Good. So we were just talking to the audience about their favorite books. Mine was The Warmth of Other Suns. I just loved that book. Yours was?
Oh, boy, if I had to choose one, it would probably be Freedom, Jonathan Franzen's
novel. Was it?
Yeah. I wrote a big review of that for our section, something I don't do too often. He's a really major, consequential writer, and from the Midwest, I will remind you.
Yes.
And this latest novel actually begins in St. Paul. Not so far away from where you all are in Madison. He is doing one of the hardest things for a novelist, which is to capture the way we live now seriously, so that when you read it, on the one hand you think, I know all this, and then on the other you realize you didn't really know it. It's just become crystalline and clear for you because of the way he's put it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's a lot of controversy surrounding Franzen, of course, and this particular novel, but I think he's a really major figure.
I did read the book, and I liked the book, but it didn't have the quality of writing that makes me think, oh, I absolutely love this book. I'm not sure why. I found it really engrossing. I read the whole thing. It was a really good read for me. But when I compare that with the writing of Isabel, and maybe this is just a matter of taste, it left me wanting.
You know, it's very interesting you say that, because something that struck me about, and Isabel's book is a major one. That was one of our 10 best of the year.
Yes.
Of course, was a great reporter at the New York Times. And has done this most extraordinary thing, which I'm sure you've told your listeners about, which is to capture what is really one of the great events in modern history, mm-hmm. one of the great migrations in all of modern history that occurred right here in the United States. And we don't think of it that way. And she was able to capture it through the experiences of just a few individuals, although the book rests on mountains of research. But, you know, to get back to the writing, what struck me when I was first reading the new novel by Franzen, Freedom, as opposed to The Corrections, this previous one, which is also a great book, I think, is it's almost intentionally written in an unliterary style. I went and back and read all of Franzen, including his first two novels, which I will confess I had not read. The first is called The 27th City. It's about St. Louis. And the second, his least known novel, is called Strong Motion. And those books are pretty good in their way. I didn't love them. They're kind of science fiction-y. They didn't feel as if they had the literary quality you're talking about. Then I went back and reread The Corrections, and by about the third page, there's one particularly long, exquisite sentence. I thought, gosh, he has become a master. And then when you go to Freedom, you see that very early on, within the first paragraph, he has a sentence. I think one of the reviewers, I believe it was Charles Baxter in the New York Review of Books, said, this sentence is so ugly, it has to be done on purpose. It has not only a double negative in, you know, when you put two no's or not, it has a quadruple negative. And then you begin to realize, or I did, that, and this is one of the interesting things about Franzen, everything he does is a decision on his part. You know, sometimes you read a novel and you think, boy, you know, I wish he or she just wrote a little better. Or don't they see that they've set up a character to do one thing and they haven't explained this other thing about him? Franzen is always doing things like that, but he is so much in control of his craft that after a while you start to ask yourself why he has decided to do this particular thing, because elsewhere in the book he'll do something very different. I'll give you an example. The first pages are set in this area, Ramsey Hill of St. Paul, which has been gentrified as the novel begins. And it kind of briefly takes you through the history of its gentrification, which began in the 1980s. But the odd thing is there's almost no physical description. You don't know what the houses look like, what the street looks like, or the neighborhood, or all the rest. And you think, well, gosh, you know, why can't Franzen give us the kind of physical description that a novelist like John Updike would? Then you'll remember as you read farther along, and suddenly you're in New York City, or you're in West Virginia, or even in South America, in Argentina and Paraguay, and you get lush physical description. So you think, okay, it's not that this guy can't do it. He's decided not to do it. He's doing something different. And if you read Franzen in that way, then all those things that seem odd actually add to the interest in the book. At least that's my interpretation, which could be 100% wrong.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's your interpretation. How could it be wrong? Plus, you're the editor of the book review section.
Well,
you've got to be right, right, Sam? Here's somebody who wants to discuss Franzen as well before we go to other books. Roberta from Barnum, Minnesota. Hi, Roberta.
Hi. I loved Freedom, and I love the way the character development was taken, how he developed the characters. I felt like I knew them. But the main thing I liked about it, and he says this somehow in the book about we're not looking at the elephant in the room. I like the fact that it was bold enough to bring out the issues of what we're doing with overpopulation and how we're treating our planet. And I don't think there are any books. People don't seem to want to talk about the problem of bringing too many people onto this planet and how we're going to be running out of the natural resources. And that is one of the underlying currents that I found very compelling, and I really appreciated his doing that.
Sam?
Thank you, Roberta. I think you're absolutely right. Is Roberta still on the line?
Yes.
What did you think of the character of Walter, who really is the one who is so invested in these issues of overpopulation, of disappearing species, of the planet? Did you find him convincing as an advocate for those issues?
I found him internally convincing, but I don't think that he had the chutzpah to go ahead and do what he needed to do. I think he needed a second partner, somebody else to help him along. you
know,
I think he believed it, but I don't think he had I don't think he knew how to go about taking care of those issues.
That's a great point. I think, you know, well, let me put this another way. I had lunch recently with one of one of the really great political thinkers in America, a Columbia historian named Mark Lilla. You may have seen his work in the New York Review of Books. Sometimes he writes for us here at the New York Times or the New York Times Magazine. He writes for me at the Book Review of the New Republic. He writes many places, written some very important books. And we were talking about politics generally, and he said, you know, he's trying to figure out the difference right now. Many of us are. I think all Americans are. This very sharp polarization between liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats. And Mark Lilla said, well, you know, when I think of the word that Republicans or conservatives would use, the one word that would define what they think their politics is, he says the word would be freedom. And I said, well, you'll want to look at Franzen's novel, because that's what he's done. And the reason I mention this is I think Roberta is right about this. I think this is part of Franzen's argument. I agree, first of all, that it's a very bold thing to try to capture the political conflicts and anxieties of this moment in a way that's not superficial, that actually works through the lives and minds and souls of characters. And I think his theme, the novel, by the way, is mainly set in the year 2004. And that's another intentional choice by Franzen, because he's talking about the year when George Bush was reelected with a very polarized country in the midst of a war, the Iraq War, and the country seems so sharply divided as it still is today. And I think this idea of freedom he interprets as being a form of fanaticism. We all become so preoccupied with this idea of our own freedom that freedom makes it difficult for us to acknowledge other people's freedoms and their disagreements with us. So what I think he did in the character of Walter Berglund, who is a Minnesotan who becomes passionately devoted to environmental issues, as Franzen himself is. You know, Franzen's written a number of essays on birding, for instance, and finding really obscure birds, following their flights, doing this all over the world. I think what he's saying and what Roberta's picked up on is Walter doesn't really have the psychological or temperamental means to translate his passions into an idea that other people can accept. That is to say, his freedom, his belief that he's right in this thing he's pursuing actually makes it hard for him to persuade others of it. And that's why in this odd way we seem to live very isolated lives in this big communal country of ours. We're all weirdly alone, even in our families, even with our friends and our communities. There's this divide, this gap that separates us from others. And that's why, in one sense, Walter Berglund is unable to communicate this passion in a constructive, meaningful way. Instead, he makes enemies all the time. He's at odds with people. He's fighting against rather than fighting for.
Thank you, Roberta, so much for your call. Let's go to Bobby from Waterloo. Hi, Bobby.
Good morning.
Hi.
We don't mean Waterloo, Iowa, do we?
No, it's actually Waterloo, Wisconsin, although I'm originally from Iowa.
Are you? See, I'm an Iowan myself. That's why I asked.
Where are you from, Sam?
Well, I lived for a number of years in Iowa City.
You did?
And I went to college at Grinnell in Iowa, where my daughter is a first-year student. So I have a big, big Iowa connection.
I went to school in Iowa City.
Oh, you went? Did you really?
Yeah.
It's a great, great place.
It is a great place. Iowa is a great place.
Oh, I love Iowa. I'm a big Iowa.
Go Iowa from Iowa.
Yay.
Okay. Bobby, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to talk about Tana French, the author, and the book that I read this last year that I decided is maybe one of the best books I've ever read is Faithful Place.
Oh, my husband gave that to me for Christmas.
Oh, I just loved it.
Did you?
Now, she's an Irish writer, so my only difficulty was she uses a lot of slang.
Yes.
So getting past that, once I got past that, I loved the way she developed the characters and the rich interplay among the characters and the family members.
Uh-huh.
It was wonderful. And her first book I read a few years ago, well, it wasn't her first book, but The Likeness was another one.
I have not read her before, and I've read about 50 pages and like it very much. You need to go to Ireland, and you'll pick up the slang in a moment. It's because you get it, and it's wonderful to hear it. And I'm from a very Irish family. It was interesting for me to read some of the phrases that my family used, and I never realized they were kind of Irish phrases.
What are some of the phrases?
You know this thing about taking a long walk off a short pier? Is that an Irish thing? Because my aunt used to say that all the time. Oh, go take a long walk off a short pier. Yeah.
I heard that growing up. Maybe that's an Iowa thing. I don't know.
Not many piers in Iowa, though.
Not many, no.
Have you read it, Sam?
I have not, and it just goes to show you, here I am in this job where I'm supposed to read everything,
well,
and there's a lot I haven't read.
How can you read everything? You just can't.
Well, you know, when I've got colleagues who actually read a lot more than I do, but I will definitely look for it.
Well, I like everything that this author has written. And her first novel got some sort of a book award, and I don't know if that was The Likeness or if that was Faithful Place.
Hmm. Okay, well,
she's an amazing author.
Yeah.
She sounds terrific.
I will continue to read it with pleasure, and more pleasure now that you've endorsed the book. Thank you. What about Patti Smith's book?
Patti Smith's book is fun. And she came in and did our podcast, and we were thrilled to death.
Oh, did she?
I walked her through the newsroom. We're on the fifth floor, and the newsroom at the Times is really the third and fourth floors. And people were jumping out of their cubicles to meet her. And it's a lovely book. You know, it really is about a particular moment in New York City. That at the time, it was just before I got here. I got here in the late 70s. She's really writing about the late 1960s and early 1970s, when New York, in some ways, was a mess. I mean, it was crime-ridden, and it was none of this sort of glittering real estate we had lost some of it after the Wall Street implosion. It felt almost like... You know, it was a more dangerous city. It felt almost like a city in a foreign country. And yet, within that environment, it was actually, in many respects, easier to be an artist than it is today. You could live very cheaply. There were lots of other young people around, particularly in downtown Manhattan, areas that are now built up and where apartments rent for, you know, $6,000 a month. You could live for $100 a month or less, and there was this very vibrant art scene. There was a kind of, to get back to, I guess, what's become my theme today, a kind of freedom in poverty and in just being able to scrape by. And so she got to know this other brilliant artist, the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, and they became best friends. And the strangest thing for your listeners who know Patti Smith's music and know how, you know, particularly in her time, how ahead of the curve she was, how avant-garde, how open she was to new experiences. She had absolutely no idea that Robert Mapplethorpe was gay. And now the most conservative person on the planet would probably figure that out
right.
in an hour, right? We all have
right.
our gaydar, as they say. Well, here was this very creative person who didn't realize that. Not that that's an important theme in the book. It's just interesting. The two of them were these kind of outsider artists who formed a very strong bond and went on to create this brilliant work. And her memoir is really a kind of Valentine to him, and because, of course, he died of AIDS, a Valentine to him and to this sort of cherished moment when Manhattan became really the provenance and almost the private property of these young creative artists.
She was with us on the show, and I was so amazed how easy it was to talk to her, Sam. She was so down to earth for all this beautiful writing and for her, you know, stardom. She didn't act like a star at all.
It was the most amazing thing. I found that, too. She came in, you know, just dressed like Patti Smith, you know, in the most casual way. She was so pleased to be here.
Aww.
And she was her book was reviewed on the cover, and she said, "You have no idea how big this is for me." And people will say that, but she actually had a legitimate reason. One of her jobs, mentioned in the memoir when she was very young,
was working as a clerk in one of the great old bookstores in Manhattan,
which
no longer exists, the Scribner's bookstore.
It was
a Brentano's, I'm sorry, right across the street from the Scribner Publishing Company on Fifth Avenue. And she said the clerks were required to read the New York Times Book Review every weekend so they would be knowledgeable when customers came in. Quite a change from today, right? And so she said to actually have her book reviewed on the cover of the Book Review was a really big deal. We all loved her. She was just great.
Yeah. Oh, that's. I'm so glad to hear that story. Sam Tannenhouse is with us. We're talking about the 10 best books of 2010. He is the editor of the Book Review section, the wonderful section of the New York Times, used to be editor of the Week in Review, which is also a wonderful section of the New York Times, which is coming up pretty soon, right? And it'll be a good section this week for the books and for what happened during 2010. Here's our phone number. We're asking you the same question, your best read, and preferably of books that were released in 2010, because that's the theme of our show. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking more phone calls for Sam, we should say that Chrissy's favorite book was Patti Smith's book. And I don't know what Rhonda's was. Rhonda's on vacation, so we'll ask her. We'll keep talking about books in 2011. Betty from La Crosse, our next caller. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. I know La Crosse.
I have a new, it's a new novelist. She has published other books in her professional area, but The Trophy Bride's Tale by Cyrilla Barr. And Cyrilla is a retired educator from the Catholic University, specialist in Italian Renaissance music. But in her research, many years of research out in Italy, I think she was there 30 times and working with archived documents of the era of the 16th century, she kept coming across this Laments of Prudenza, and she just felt compelled to tell the story, and I was able to go to her book signing. She's now retired in La Crosse, and it's just a compelling read filled with authentic research. You feel like you're in Italy. And Prudenza was a victim of domestic abuse in the 16th century, a talented musician who was a promised bride in a merchant exchange in Florence, which takes place ultimately in Florence, Italy. It's just compelling. And for her years of experience in the academic world, she is a very good novelist as far as the flow.
Oh, it sounds really good. Do you know it, Sam?
Yeah, I don't, but you know, I can imagine how good it might be. Because one of the more interesting things that happens in literature, it happens periodically, is when a really learned person, the novelist Thomas Flanagan was another example, masters some area of research, particularly if it's historical or has connection to the humanities in some ways, and because they're so well-read and are so thoughtful, they're able to translate it and to translate that knowledge into storytelling, and you feel as if you're getting information and a revelation on every page. That's a novel I'll really look for.
Oh, I will, too. That sounds wonderful. And it for me, it would be going outside what I usually read, too, which would be nice.
Well, and, you know, because she's an educator, as the caller said, she may have a good sense of how it is to pull an ordinary reader into that world.
Right.
Because she's been teaching students all these years.
Right, right. Here are some emails that have come in. We'll just go through these, and you can pick up on whatever you want. Deborah in Milwaukee, fiction, The Help, her favorite read, nonfiction, The Woman Behind the New Deal, about Frances Perkins. We did that interview by Kristen Downey. I love that book, too. Fred and Baraboo, Griftopia by Matt Taibbi. See your doctor before reading it due to the fact that it will jack your blood pressure above medically safe limits. And, any of those strike your fancy?
Yeah, those are all consequential books. We actually got to Matt Taibbi's book a little late, so for us, it was too late to include that book in our 100 notable for this year. You know, we do it in an odd way. It's not actually the calendar year. We do it from the date of the issue, the previous issue from a year before that had the 100 notables.
Oh,
then the next issue we do the 10 best. And then so we cycle through for another year. So we're a little bit off on the dates. You know, it's like using the Russian calendar or something. So unless a book has been reviewed in our pages during that period, it can't qualify. The Help, of course, was one of the big surprises of the year. I have not read it.
I haven't either.
Many who have, including one of my bosses, the managing editor at the Times, Jill Abramson, who loved it. And I was once on a train. I've never seen this happen before. It's every author's dream. I take a commuter train to Tarrytown in Westchester. It's about 40 minutes away from Grand Central Station here in Midtown. And the woman seated across the aisle to me on my right was reading The Help. And the woman seated to my left was also reading The Help.
Oh, my goodness.
They got off at the same stop and started talking about the novel. They left the train. It was really funny. I'm an author, too, so it made me very envious. And Frances Perkins, great figure, you know, and a very good subject for a biography. You know, we think even now of politics, particularly in the earlier period, you know, the New Deal era, 1930s, you know, through World War II, as being so dominated by men. It was a man's world,
yes,
you know,
right,
the smoke-filled rooms and the card playing and all the rest. And here was one of the most influential and powerful figures, a shaper of the New Deal,
sure,
the labor
was
secretary, who's a woman, you know. And it's always good to learn that the past is more complex than we sometimes think
mm-hmm.
it was.
The thing I liked about Matt is, I think he's a heck of a writer, but he took this subject, which he admitted he knew nothing about, and it seems to me as though if you're trained to be a fine journalist, or if you are, you can take something you know nothing about, and I didn't know much about it either, and let me know what was going on, and really become somewhat of an expert in a field. That's a gift. That's hard work, dude.
That's right. That's right. And that's the fun of writing journalism. You know, I tell people sometimes, being a journalist is like being in school, but you don't go to class. You know, you're spending all your time in the library or talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't mean you, you know, you read a lot, you bone up a lot, but you're not lectured to in the same way. And, you know, I always enjoyed my lectures in college. But there's this idea that you're in a new area, and because you're learning it so quickly, you kind of process it the way a so-called civilian would. So everything Taibbi learns about Wall Street and about, you know, high finance and these instruments and all the rest that we were hearing about endlessly in that period, is he, in a way, is learning it in the best manner for conveying that information to other people, because he's learning it as he goes along, and he takes you with him.
Right.
And, of course, he was the inventor of that, you know, tremendous phrase that you know, the vampire squid, right, that our columnist,
right,
Frank Rich, loved to quote. And, you know, that's important for journalists, especially a magazine journalist. Magazine journalists, where I used to be one, work a little differently from newspaper journalists, from reporters. Magazine journalists have to kind of work in the realm of narrative a little bit more than a regular beat reporter will. See, our reporters at the Times who cover business and finance and did it very well actually are, if not experts in their field, very well trained in it. You know, they usually either have degrees or they've been working in the area for so long and talking to so many experts over so long a period that they really do gain an almost professional knowledge of the area. But for a magazine writer who's out there discovering this new realm, he can kind of capture it with an excitement that you don't,
yes,
always see in,
yes,
very accurate but straightforward newspaper accounts.
Marty in Bennett is next. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. Well, I'm going to kind of break a little bit of the rules here. I don't think either of my books were written this year, but one was the most compelling and one was the best read. But before I tell you them, what was the book, the Ireland book that you got for Christmas, The Woman Loved? I missed the name of that, Kathleen.
The name of the book is, hold on a second, I'm going to be, yeah, what the heck is the name of the book? Faithful Place. Faithful Place by Tana French, I think her name is.
Okay.
French. Tana is T-A-N-A.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I bet I'm not the only one who was wondering that. The most compelling book I read, and I read it at the beginning of the year, so I'm a little vague on a lot of the details, was Madame Mao, about Mao Zedong's wife.
Mm.
Would be a great show, Kathleen, by
okay.
the way.
Okay.
Because what the heck did we know about her?
Right.
And, boy, she knew everything. She knew everything that was going on. A somewhat challenging book to read because the names and the intricacy of life was kind of hard to keep track of. But, oh, man, that was just such a very, very compelling book. But what I really loved this year, I know Elizabeth Strout wrote Olive Kittredge, and everybody was reading it and loved it. But I just loved Amy and Isabel, which is one that came out a little earlier of hers. If you were a woman raised in the 50s and 60s, if you were a girl or a teenager in the 50s and 60s, boy, does she put you back there in the blink of an eye.
Huh.
I could feel it. I could smell it. I knew the cologne I was wearing. Just, it's an amazing story of a woman and her daughter. And, you know, moms out there with daughters will just resonate with it. I just thought that was a brilliant, brilliant book.
Oh, Marty, you sold me. Sam, are you familiar with it?
I'm not. Of course, Olive Kittredge was a prize winner and bestseller, and most of Elizabeth Strout's novels are bestsellers, and she has a very loyal following.
Mm-hmm.
I would be curious to read that. A novel I really enjoyed was, and I'm blanking on the title of it just now, was Anna Quinlan's latest novel, which is also it's about a family, and it's set in the contemporary period. It's in the
every summer. Last one, Sam.
That's it, every last one. And it's frightening in some ways and disturbing.
Yes, it is.
But what she's really good at, too, is capturing the feel of that earlier period, you know, that when her adult characters came of age. Another writer who's really good at that, and why am I blanking on her name? Because she won the National Book Award for Charming Billy. She's a really good novelist. We know who she is. She's from Long Island. Why am I blanking on her name? I will think of it as we go.
Okay.
let me mention two books. Since this caller confessed that two of the books she liked best weren't published this year, let me mention two books that didn't make either one of our lists, the 100 notable or the 10 best, yet could easily have been on either one, and we didn't include them for a particular reason. They are two collections of letters. One is by the great novelist Saul Bellow, and the other by Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
Oh.
And Bellow and Moynihan, of course, are both deceased. And Bellow died in 2004, and Moynihan, I believe, in 2003. And Alex McDermott was
in yes, yes.
before.
There
and,
you go.
And the reason we didn't include them was these are both magnificent feats of editing. There were thousands and thousands of pages the editors worked through in both cases and selected a lot. I mean, they're large, 500-600-page books, but selected carefully, took 10% or 20% of all the possible material to give shape to these two volumes. And what they do is take you inside the minds of two of the greatest modern Americans. Bellow, I think most would say this is our greatest novelist in the post-war era, probably the greatest since Faulkner, another Midwesterner, I'll add, from Chicago. And Moynihan was the last true intellectual in American politics. And when you see how they thought through the great questions of the day, in Bellow's case, how does one write a truly ambitious novel, you know, when with the dimension of a Tolstoy or a Proust or a Joyce, how does one do it as a modern American? What are the obstacles, the challenges? What are the risks you have to take? And then in Moynihan's case, how do you use politics to make it the vehicle of an improved life for everyone in the society? How does politics become the instrument of an ideal vision of America? When you read these books and see the quality of their intellect and of their prose, you can easily decide, as we did, I wrote a little note about this, that there was more good writing, more good thinking on any page of those two books than probably in anything else that was published this year.
Oh my goodness.
Most of the letters were written many years ago, and neither author is alive.
Yeah, oh, I'll have to get those. Sam, a great pleasure to speak with you. Have a wonderful new year, and we're looking forward to all that you'll be giving us in terms of reviews.
It was a pleasure, Kathleen.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks. Goodbye. Sam Tannenhaus, the best books of 2010, our subject this hour. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls, too. If you want to post something on our Facebook, those would be nice messages to receive of your best read for 2010, because people love book suggestions. You're an absolutely not-to-be-beat audience in that regard. Thanks to Chrissy Peace for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well, and thanks for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we will meet an author, appropriately enough, that will follow what's going on in the world. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.